It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. You count on WPR for news, conversations, and music that keep you informed and connected. We are in our spring member drive. We're not taking a lot of time to talk about it, so you can get the news you need in this unique time. That is why your support right now on this last weekday of the drive is so important. And staying cozy is important, too. Ask for your WPR socks, a longtime listener favorite, when you give $10 a month or more. You can do that at 888-202-2552. That's 888-202-2552. Or go online at WPR.org and thank you. Coming up, how much do you know about what's in the stuff you eat, and does that influence what you decide to eat? We'll talk to a chemist who has some ideas that could change or maybe justify your decision-making. Now it's this week's edition of Food Friday. A lot of people are getting into baking or back into baking during the current stay-at-home orders. And some people have written that they've turned to baking as a way to relieve anxiety and share something sweet with their loved ones. Our next guest is a prolific baker who says that baking while remaining at home is, in a way, a show of faith. Dori Greenspan is a baker and cook. She's the author of several cookbooks, including Everyday Dori and Dori's Cookies. Dori, welcome back to Central Time.
So good to be with you again. Thank you. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you?
I'm okay. Are you baking?
I've done a little. You know what I've done is I'm a big bread pudding guy, and I have my freezers often stuffed with bread butts and old rolls that didn't get finished and things like that. So I've been exploring the freezer and making bread pudding, which my kids hate, but my wife and I will eat it. What are you baking lately? I know you've got recipes up and things like that, but what's your comfort baking?
Well, my comfort baking is cookies.
Yeah.
And I've got. Actually, I'm home with my husband, our son, and his wife. And Lin Ling, our daughter-in-law, just made world peace cookies. So I'm looking at some brownies that I made and some world peace cookies that she made. And it's a chocolate day here. But my husband's a bread baker, and so I make bread pudding as well, because we, like you, have all those little ends and small pieces. Yeah.
What is a world peace cookie?
Oh, the world peace cookie. So this is a cookie. I got the recipe more than 20 years ago from a Paris baker, Pierre Hermé. And at that time, I published it in a book in 2002 called Paris Sweets, and we called the cookie the Kurova cookie because he had made it for a restaurant in Paris called Kurova. And it's a chocolate cookie, kind of a cross between a shortbread and a chocolate chip cookie. It's dark, dark chocolate made with cocoa, has pieces of chocolate in it, and it has some salt in it, which was just, you know, a revolutionary at the turn of the century. And I loved the cookie, and a neighbor of mine, just as I was getting ready to turn in my manuscript for baking from my home to yours, a neighbor of mine said, you know those chocolate cookies with the funny name? I said, yeah. He said, whatever that name is, that's not what we call them. We call them world peace cookies, because if all the world had these cookies, peace would reign.
Wow.
And so I republished the cookie under the name World Peace Cookie. And the recipe is all, if you Google it, World Peace Cookie, you'll find it. And it's an extraordinarily good cookie. And it's a slice and bake. It's, you know, an icebox cookie. So it's easy to make and so delicious.
We're talking to Dori Greenspan about baking in a time of safer at home orders right now. Now, Dori, a thing I don't think I've ever talked to you about, but I found it on your website. A lot of people are maybe baking right now for the first time. Your first kitchen experiment didn't go well. Can you share that story with us to let people know that, hey, however bad it goes, it probably went better than Dori Greenspan's first try?
Oh, it probably went better indeed. So I was with friends, and I was in seventh grade, and we wanted to make frozen French fries. And so we didn't read the back of the box, and we didn't know it was supposed to go in the oven. So I put a big pot of oil up to boil on the stove. And the only thing I remembered from science class was that water boils faster if you put a cover on the pot. So I put a cover on the pot of oil, and when I lifted the cover, the flames were just, they were beautiful, and they were dangerous.
Oh, no.
And, yeah, and that was my parents' newly renovated kitchen that was on fire. Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So I wasn't allowed to cook or bake it. Well, I never baked then. I wasn't allowed back in the kitchen. And I started cooking and baking as a college student. I got married as a college student. And that's when I started and just found – it's interesting. I was thinking about this recently. I loved cooking, and I had to cook because – you know, we had no money, we couldn't go out, you know, and I was excited about learning to cook. But I learned to bake for the comfort of it. Even then, I've been thinking about this a lot because, of course, many of us are baking for comfort now. I would come home from school and I would bake. Later, I would go, you know, I'd have a job and I'd, you know, work like mad. And I would come home and baking was what relaxed me. And then I went to graduate school and worked. And I would come home from school and work, and I would bake. And I've been thinking about it because all through my life, baking has been a way to just focus, to center, to have a moment to think about things, to take pleasure in we use all your senses when you're baking. And so to take pleasure in actually making something. And all of that feels so important now.
Dory, for people who are making that first trip into the kitchen, apart from not setting that cauldron of oil on fire, what is a good first step for baking where, you know, it's likely they're going to be successful to have an easy win to point to in their first try?
Do you know, just go to the, I mean, I've according to somebody who actually added up all of my recipes, I have more than 3,000 recipes in print, but I would tell you, just if you've never baked before, grab a bag of chocolate chips and follow the recipe on the back of the bag. It's foolproof, and you will feel so good that you have made something. I mean, I have a bunch of recipes I'd be happy to give you. But if you've never baked before, make some chocolate chip cookies. They're fun to make. The house will smell good. You'll be so happy that you've done that
is a great way to start. And now you did share a recipe with us, the Cabin Fever caramel banana bars. This one's from Dory's Cookies. Cabin Fever, anything with that in the title sounds like a good cookie to make, or a bar, I guess, to make right now. What's the story behind these guys?
Well, actually, I made these cookies when the second blizzard in 6 days hit Connecticut. And I had cabin fever. I also had one overripe banana. And so that's how I made this recipe. And in wanting to share a recipe with you, I thought, this is the perfect one. There's no blizzard, but I think a lot of us have cabin fever.
Definitely. Now, tell us a little bit about what goes into this, apart from that maybe a little bit overripe banana.
That, well, yes, actually it's the riper the better for this. So I make a quick little caramel by just melting some brown sugar and butter together. And it's a very simple recipe. It gets a little bit of, so it's flour and not much flour. I mean, it's only a cup of flour. Flour is at a premium these days,
right?
At least it is, you know, here. So it's, you know, the typical flour and sugar. I add some cardamom, but you can use any. You could use cinnamon or nutmeg if you want it. And it's got just a little bit of sour cream or yogurt in it for that tang. And I do a topping. Well, I had salted peanuts, and so it's optional. But there are peanuts in the cookie, so it's really It's a bar, so it's really like a tender cake that's cut into small bars. And then if you've got some chocolate in the house, you can just swipe it over the top and put some peanuts over that. So it's got caramel and a little bit of spice and that tang from the yogurt and the sweetness from banana and chocolate. It's really a great bar, and it's super simple to make.
Dory Greenspan is with us, author of several cookbooks, including Everyday Dory and Dory's Cookies. We've got, by the way, that banana caramel bar, the Cabin Fever caramel banana bar, up at WPR.org/Food Friday. Dory is with us to talk about baking projects during the time of Safer at Home, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you getting into baking for the first time right about now, or are you getting back into baking? Do you have a comfort food that you like to bake, that you enjoy baking and hopefully also enjoy eating? Do you need some advice? Do you have a question? Do you need some inspiration? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time or the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. It's Food Friday. We're talking about baking projects from beginner to advanced that you can do while you're at home. Dory Greenspan is with us, well-known baker and cook and author of all manner of cookbooks, including Everyday Dory and Dory's Cookies. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What have you, if anything, been baking lately? What are you baking right now? If you got it in the oven and you could take a minute for a phone call, are you getting into it for the first time or maybe re-nurturing a love of baking? Are you having to ad lib a little bit because you don't have the ingredients, don't want to make that trip to the grocery store for just the one thing? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Find a recipe for Dory's Cabin Fever Caramel Banana Bars over at WPR.org/Food Friday. Let's go to your calls now. Chip is with us in Stoughton. Chip, hello.
Hello. Yes, I'm calling from Stoughton.
Yeah, what do you got for us, Chip?
Well, ever since I was a kid, my neighbor mother, she was from Holland, and she would bake a chocolate cake with apricot filling in two layers. So she would cut, it into. I guess it would be three or four layers, and she would put apricot preserves in two of the layers, and then buttercream frosting in the middle, and of course across the top and sides, and it's just the most wonderful moist cake. I bake one about every 6 months, and I can eat that whole cake by myself in 2 days.
Fantastic. Chip, thank you so much for sharing it with us. A good memory,
so good.
For one thing there, Dory, and it sounds fantastic, too. Have you encountered anything like that? I've never done chocolate and apricot together, I don't think.
You know, Chip, when you started to talk about it, it made me think of the Austrian Sachertorte, one cake cut in half with apricot jam in the center and a chocolate glaze over. But that's I love chocolate and apricot together. What a nice story. Thank you.
Sounds like a great combination, Chip. Thank you for sharing that with us. We'll go to Pamela now in Sturgeon Bay. Pamela, hi.
Hi. Good to talk to you. Great show. Loving the baking stuff.
Yeah, what are you baking, Pamela?
Well, yesterday I made peanut butter bread, and it was based on a recipe from the Depression, from a Depression-era cookbook. Which I ran into it, an article online, and thought this is really cool. So actually, mine actually turned out to be a combination of cashew butter, peanut butter, and almond butter, since I have not all those things. And there's no oil and no eggs in it, just baking powder, flour, peanut butter, and some milk.
Wow, super easy. Is it good, Pamela?
It's delicious. Oh, a little bit of sugar too. It's delicious. It turned out. Better than I would have thought it would have, but it came recommended, so I gave it a roll, and it's really yummy.
Oh, how nice. I have a question. Was it baked in a loaf pan?
Yes, it's a quick bread.
It is a quick bread. Yeah, you would think with all that, the the fat from the nut butters. That would just be delicious. I could see why you don't need butter in it. Mmm, what a nice idea.
That sounds really good, Pamela. Thanks for calling. She mentioned that, you know, using the Depression era cookbook, and I wanted to ask you, Dory, we're seeing a lot of people raise the questions of, I want to bake, but I'm out of eggs, or I want to bake, but I'm out of whatever. Do you have some suggestions on what is safe to substitute in making, I don't know, cookies and quick breads and things like that?
Well, so there have been recently, I always tease and say that it's not cheese, it's the truth. I took both science and math for poets when I was in college. So the fact that I'm a baker is kind of remarkable because science is not my strong point. So the substitutions are something. But there have recently been a number of really good articles talking about substitutions. Today, in today's New York Times, and it's the Times is by subscription, but this is available to everyone. There's a story by Erin Jean McDowell, a wonderful pastry chef, about flour substitutions. And I know flour has really been in short supply. People are using aquafaba from chickpeas in place of eggs. There are, but this is something I feel completely unqualified, but to give one for one advice. But there are a lot of people right now who are doing some very, very helpful lists of substitutions.
That's
flour
fantastic.
Flour has been hard to come by, and a lot of people have been able to find gluten-free flour that you can use as a one-to-one. One cup of regular flour would be the same as one cup of gluten-free flour, and that, for some reason, has not been in short supply. So that's a good sub for all-purpose flour.
Thanks again for that call, Pamela, at 800-642-1234. It's Food Friday. Dory Greenspan is with us, giving us some advice and inspiration and recipes on some comfort baking when we're often just stuck at home. Dory, I saw a recipe you had in the New York Times, and correct me if I'm pronouncing it wrong, gougères?
Very nicely done.
Nice.
Yes, gougères.
Tell us about these. This was a new one to me. It looked really good in the picture, though, I'll say.
This is one of my all-time favorite things to make. So gougères are cheese puffs. The dough is a pâte à choux. It's a cream puff dough, the exact same dough you would use for éclair. So it's a dough that's not sweet nor savory. You make it either sweet or savory. And with gougères, you make the dough, and you add cheese to it. And in that recipe, I added cheese, mustard, and nuts, which is very unusual. It's a French recipe. We think that its origins are in Burgundy, and it's often served when you go to a French restaurant, and one day we will again be able to go to French restaurants. Particularly in Burgundy, you would get a kir, which is white wine and creme de cassis, and a gougère as something to just whet your appetite, welcome you to the meal. And I've been making gougère for, I don't know, maybe 25 years. And you can freeze the dough. As soon as you make the dough and you scoop out the little balls, the little puffs, they can go directly in the freezer, and then they can go from the freezer to the oven without defrosting. And so I make a batch, I put them in the freezer, and as soon as friends come, I have them in the oven. The people knock on the door, they open the door, you can smell the warm cheese, the fragrance coming out of the kitchen, and then I serve them hot with white wine. And so I wrote about gougère because I'm thinking both back and forward. I'm thinking of all the good times that I had having friends come home for dinner, and I'm looking forward to doing it again. And so when I wrote that I make gougère as an act of faith, I make gougère and I put them in the oven because I have faith that we'll be together again.
That's fantastic. I love that story. Now, I hear Gougère, it's a French name, and I think, oh, it's going to be too fancy for, you know, a simple fellow like Rob to make. Is it not that tricky, though?
Cheese puffs. Cheese puffs. That's what they are. Yeah, so it's actually, the dough is fascinating. It's the only dough I know that you first cook on the stove and then pop in the oven. So it's really, you know, the thing about baking, I've always felt this way. It's really easier than cooking. And I've met so many people who say, oh, I'm afraid of baking. It's so precise. It's so scientific.
Yeah, but
the thing is, if you have a good recipe, you follow it. It's unlike cooking where it might say season to taste or you need, you know, there are so many judgment calls in cooking. In baking, if the recipe is solid and you follow it, you'll be successful. And so Gougère are just follow the recipe. You can do it, Rob.
Maybe I'll try this one. I do have that mild fear of baking exactly because of the precision, but maybe I should give it a shot. I'll have some time this weekend.
Even when something doesn't come out just the way the picture looks, it's usually delicious. The ingredients that you use for baking are so good that you put them together, you put them in the oven. Maybe you didn't bake it enough. Maybe you baked it a little bit too much. Maybe it's just a little lopsided. It's usually always delicious.
Well, Dori, it's been a lot of fun, and I hope you can pull those Gougères out of the freezer for visiting friends sometime pretty soon.
Thank you. And I hope you make them and enjoy them this weekend. It's been great to talk to you. Thank you.
You too. That's Dori Greenspan, baker and cook. She's written a bunch of cookbooks. They include Everyday Dori and Dori's Cookies. She joined us to talk about baking projects you can tackle while you're at home. By the way, you play a huge role in funding WPR programs and all the conversations you hear. We're having kind of a quiet spring member drive to ask for your support. This is the last chance to give today during Central Time. Make a gift right now online at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552. Again, WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And thanks for your support. Coming up, coffee, Cheetos, cigarettes. We break down some ways to think about the chemicals that we put in and on ourselves. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the push and pull between the economy and public health continues after Governor Evers extended safer at home guidelines until late May. We'll talk about how to balance health and economic concerns during the COVID-19 outbreak. First, think of the humble Cheeto. Cheesy, crispy, salty, powdery, and processed. Bon Appetit pastry chef Claire Saffitz attempted to reverse engineer and recreate a gourmet version of the popular snack.
They're so good. They're very cheesy. So crunchy. Is this what I've been missing for the last 25 years of my life? And these are flaming hot. Oh my God, look at the color. Ooh, not found in nature.
It's a safe bet to put Cheetos in the junk food category, but do we know whether processed foods like this are actually bad for us? And if so, how bad? George Zidane says it's hard to say, so maybe don't beat yourself up about indulging from time to time. George Zidane is a science communicator, television and web host and producer. He created National Geographic's web series Ingredients. His first book is called Ingredients, The Strange Chemistry of What We Put In Us and On Us. George, welcome to Central Time.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, George, a weird question to start with. A lot of times we ask guests to check their levels by asking what they had for breakfast in the morning. Given the subject of your book, I'm really curious. What did you have for breakfast this morning?
I had my usual breakfast, which is, believe it or not, just a cup of coffee and nothing else.
Okay. Now, coffee is one of the topics of your book. And one of the kind of organizing principles and inspiring ideas here is how do we evaluate the health impact of any of all the zillions of different things we eat or put on us and things like that? Can you talk about what you were shooting for here?
Yes. So I'll give you a really short answer and then a longer answer. The super short answer is it's hard. It's really hard to evaluate the long-term impact of food on our health. The longer answer is, you know, it's specifically when it comes to processed food, which is where I kind of start the book, mm-hmm. but, you know, we talk about other stuff too, but, you know, there's sort of a layer cake of reasons of why it's difficult. The first layer in the cake is it's actually kind of hard to define what you mean by processed. And in order to study something scientifically, you do have to define it, because if you're going to do a study based on, you know, that's looking at processed food, at some point, someone's going to have to go to the grocery store and buy the things for your study, right? So you need to know what exactly you're defining as processed food. The second layer in the layer cake of why it's hard is that a lot of times with food and long-term studies like this, so things that last 5, 10, 15 years or even longer, it's actually fairly hard to measure accurately what people are eating. And that's because it's hard to remember what you ate. Like you asked me what I, you know, had for breakfast this morning, and that was a fairly easy answer.
That was an easy one.
Yeah, but like if I were to ask you what you had for dinner 2 weeks ago or 2 months ago, or to average your consumption of, let's say, cantaloupes over the last 4 months, it would be a fairly challenging question for you to answer. Unless you happen to know exactly how many cantaloupes you eat every single day.
I don't. Zero most days, honestly.
Zero, yeah. There you go. Yeah. And then the sort of the third layer cake, yeah, the third layer in the cake is once you get that sort of that data back from people, depending on the way you analyze it, and there are many different ways to analyze that data, you could come out with literally the exact opposite results. And you see that in the headlines, and coffee is a perfect example. If you search for like coffee and heart disease risk over the past three decades, you will see headlines that line up on both sides of the issue exactly the opposite. Some say, you know, coffee will increase your risk of heart disease. Others say coffee will reduce your risk of heart disease. And so, you know, the temptation with that is like, well, okay, if science is saying, you know, both things, then I'm just going to like ignore it and move on with my life because science clearly doesn't know what it's talking about. And that's actually not true. Depending on how you analyze data and depending on a whole loads of other factors, you can actually get different results. And the way science progresses is, you know, you do not just one study, right? You do a bunch of studies over time. People have debates, arguments. They write to each other in scientific journals and say, you know, you're wrong because X. And then eventually over a long period of time, you do get to a consensus. So with coffee, for example, roughly 3 years ago, the largest and sort of most detailed analysis of the long-term impacts of coffee on your health was published. And it seems to say, I'm happy to report, that there are very few bad health impacts from coffee. The only exception being if you're pregnant, you want to limit your caffeine intake roughly to about a cup of coffee a day. But, you know, the scary headlines from the very, very early days where it said, you know, coffee is going to increase your risk of a heart attack by 30%, those seem to have been disproven.
One thing that makes it even trickier is the correlation or causation argument. So
yes.
If we have people eating a bunch of, say, brand name cheesy puffs of some sort, and they have worse health outcomes than everybody else, is it because of the cheesy puffs, or is that just a marker that they may be in a certain demographic, age group, or they may also do certain behaviors that go along with that? That makes it even harder to tease this stuff out, right?
Absolutely. You totally hit the nail on the head with that one. And that's part of the big debate between these two groups is you've got one group saying like, you know, that data is known in the field as observational data. And the counterpoint to that is the data that you get out of a randomized controlled trial. So the observational data is what it sounds like. You're following people over time. You're not trying to change their behavior. You're just getting them to tell you what they ate, and then you're associating that or correlating that with, let's say, bad health outcomes. On the other side of the coin, the randomized controlled trial, which was considered the gold standard in medicine, is you actually split people up into different groups. You give one group a certain treatment or food or whatever. You don't give it to the other group, and then you compare the results at the end at the end of that trial. You know, at the time of writing of this book, there was exactly one randomized controlled trial that compared ultra-processed food versus minimally processed food in a healthy group of people. And that maybe is surprising to folks because they might think like, oh, you know, science is clear. Like, we really know ultra-processed food is bad for you, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, just one randomized controlled trial at this point. And it did indicate that if you eat more ultra-processed food, you do put on weight. But the trial was a month long, and there's only so much that you can discover in a month. Like, a month-long trial is not going to tell you, does it increase your risk of a heart attack or diabetes, right? So there's all these, you know, science is a puzzle. You've got randomized controlled trials, you've got observational data, you've got animal models, you've got all kinds of other stuff. And trying to put that puzzle together and get a complete picture is really, really tough.
We're talking to George Zeidan. His new book is called Ingredients, The Strange Chemistry of What We Put in Us and on Us. It sounds hopeless, George, but on the other hand, we figured out to stop using formaldehyde to preserve milk. We stopped making energy drinks with radium in them. And we figured out, despite all these complexities, that smoking is bad for us. Can you talk about when we can, with certainty, say, yeah, this thing, this habit, this whatever, we shouldn't be doing it?
Yes, and that's a great point. So for the things like formaldehyde and radium, those will usually have a pretty pretty quick impact on your health. And that's true of poisons in general, you know, cyanide or whatever. Like, that's, it's very clear that cyanide is bad for you because it has a immediate and dramatic impact on your health. For things like smoking, you know, you can smoke a cigarette and you're not going to keel over immediately, right? So it's not as obvious that they're bad for you. And this was a big part of the argument back in the 1940s, 50s, when this really was unknown still. So what you have to do there is exactly the observational trials I was talking about before. Is you take, you know, you've got groups of people and you follow them over a long, long period of time. You ask them how much they smoke, and then you correlate the results. And when it comes to something like smoking, first of all, the trials were enormous. Even in 1964, a total of 1 million people had been in these observational trials. And second of all, the results were dramatic. I mean, you had people, so on average, if you smoke your entire life, your life expectancy is roughly 10 years shorter than if you don't smoke. And furthermore, the more you smoke, the greater the impact on your life. So those kind of dramatic results were part of the puzzle that really convinced the Surgeon General to unequivocally state back in 1964, and we still know this is true today, that smoking causes lung cancer and definitely does take a substantial number of years off of your life. And by the way, since 1964, we now have a much better picture of the actual chemistry behind how it does that. First, we figured out that it does do that, and then afterwards, in the intervening years, we figured out what the sort of molecular basis of why smoking is bad for you and why it increases your risk of lung cancer so much.
Let's bring things home as we wrap up, George, to the processed foods that started you on this adventure here. Research is still being done. I assume it will continue to be done. The state of the art right now, what do we mean by processed foods, and should we throw them all away? Should we eat them with abandon? Where are we right now on that?
Well, you've laid out a good spectrum, right? my personal feeling is, we're in the early stages of research on ultra-processed food. I would wait a little bit longer before moving to either end of that spectrum. I think you're okay if you're somewhere in the middle. That's kind of where I plan to be.
George, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's George Zeidan, executive producer at the American Chemical Society. He's the author of the new book, Ingredients, The Strange Chemistry of What We Put in Us and on Us. Coming up, President Trump wants the economy reopened by May 1st, while governors across the country are weighing extending safer-at-home guidelines to stop the spread of COVID-19. We'll look at some of what policy experts and lawmakers are trying to weigh. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, fish farming is seeing some growth in Wisconsin, and sometimes fish and lettuce are growing together at aquaponics facilities. A UW expert tells us how it works and what it can mean for the state's economy. Now, Governor Tony Evers announced yesterday that he will extend safer-at-home guidelines with some modifications by more than a month to May 26th. While the move could potentially slow the spread of COVID-19 in the state, it angered some Republican lawmakers who say Wisconsin's economy is taking too big a hit. Across the country, other state governments are faced with a similar dilemma. At the federal level, President Trump has expressed a desire to states to start getting back into business by May 1st. He encouraged his supporters who have been protesting the extension of these safer-at-home orders, tweeting today, "Liberate" to several states. Vicki Beer is the director of the Center for Human Performance and Risk Analysis at the University of Wisconsin-Madison College of Engineering and a professor of Industrial and Systems Engineering. She has also worked on pandemic preparedness. Vicki, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, the big question people are weighing is how soon can we go back to normal? What steps are safe to go back to normal? When we're evaluating risks, what are the kind of things you think we should be weighing before we make these decisions?
Sure. One thing I would look at is that very likely the majority of states or cities, counties, are not going to make an all-or-nothing decision. It's not going to be come May 1 or May whatever the date is that suddenly we are totally back to normal the way we were 3 months ago. I think there are going to be a lot of gradual phases of opening up. So, for example, if you look at particular industries or economic sectors, there may be some that have relatively a high impact on GDP and not an enormous amount of person-to-person contact. So construction might be an example of that. And those might be some sectors that would be allowed to return to work earlier than others, parts of the manufacturing sector. I don't think, for example, that we're going to have, you know, big sporting stadiums full, you know, on June 1st, probably anywhere in the country. So,
what do you make of the different approaches taken by states? First of all, are there any states that you point to and say, yeah, they're probably getting it right about now?
So the state that has impressed me the most, actually, is Ohio. Governor Mike DeWine there has done, I think, a very good job, first of all, of being very early and proactive on some of the precautions. He also looks like he is taking a pretty careful and thoughtful approach to what parts of the economy can be reopened. Until just recently, Wisconsin had been following more or less right along in Ohio's footsteps, a day or two behind on most decisions. And I think the fact that Ohio is now looking at a partial reopening and Wisconsin is looking at, you know, a more extended, safer at home period with very little modification is kind of the first time I've seen a real discrepancy between the Wisconsin and Ohio approaches.
Is part of the reason for that maybe that, as you said, Ohio got ahead of it earlier, and by acting early, they bought themselves a little more flexibility now?
Well, they certainly did act early. I don't think I have looked closely enough to know whether their case numbers or rate of growth are dramatically less than Wisconsin's. I think, you know, the two states have been pretty similar in most respects. So I'm not sure exactly why they are taking different approaches right now. But
one thing that I've seen a lot of people saying is, okay, yes, we want to get back to something closer than normal. But one of the steps we need in place before we can do that is way more testing so that we can detect people who have the illness, maybe even people who have it without symptoms, and then have much more selective quarantines or lockdowns or whatever we call them, rather than this sort of everybody stays home as much as possible approach. How do we evaluate how much testing is enough testing to do that?
Okay. First of all, there is no magic number of enough testing. In general, more testing is probably almost always better than less testing. I don't think we're in a situation where we absolutely cannot move forward due to lack of testing. Certainly, we could move forward probably faster if we had more testing. One thing that I think people are not necessarily thinking about as much is the possibility of surveillance testing. That right now, if we're mainly testing people who are either sick or exposed, that's a pretty limited number of people. To ramp up to test everybody is obviously not practical right now, but we could probably do random sampling of, you know, maybe 1,000 people statewide or 1,000 people in each major metropolitan area or things like that to get just a sense of which areas have more and less viral load, so to speak, and which ones can maybe move a little faster if you find, you know, very, very few cases out of 1,000 random samples in one area and more cases in another area. That might allow for a more fine-tuned approach without overwhelming amounts of testing.
I know you've worked on pandemic response in the past. Are there things about this COVID-19 and the, you know, the virus that causes it that kind of caught us off guard here that didn't behave like we would like viruses to behave?
Yeah. Well, certainly the fact that there seems to be a lot of either asymptomatic spread or spread by people with very mild symptoms who have no reason to think that they're seriously ill, I think that has made the whole process of contact tracing and trying to stamp out the disease much, much more challenging, and also made testing therefore more important because it's more difficult to know who might be spreading it.
Vicki, earlier you gave us some ideas of the kinds of early steps we could take toward reopening certain types of businesses. What other kinds of things would you think of as our first steps in the next, I don't know, 2-3 weeks?
So I don't know what next steps Wisconsin is going to have in the near term, because, again, the safer-at-home order was just extended. But one of the things people are thinking about is, first of all, that as businesses, restaurants, et cetera, do reopen, they will probably be at reduced capacity. For example, you know, half seating in the restaurant or maybe by appointment only at stores so that there's only a certain number of people there at any one time. Probably also bans on mass gatherings for quite a long period of time. You know, no more than 50 people probably could continue for quite a while until we have a vaccine or other better solutions.
And when you're talking about quite a long time, I've seen people say, you know, a year or many months at least till, knock on wood, we have a vaccine. Probably it sounds like you're saying, as we wrap up, Vicki, we're going to need to be doing something for a lot longer even than this stay-at-home order.
Yeah, I think if the stay-at-home order is ended in, you know, end of May, that yes, we may still have a lot of changes in our lives for the next year or so. Just as one example, probably much less travel, you know, big conferences, things like that are likely to be canceled, postponed, or done virtually. So, yeah, I think there's going to be some long-term changes that the world is not going to go back to normal suddenly at the beginning of June.
Vicki, thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure thing. Thank you.
Vicki Beer is the director of the Center for Human Performance and Risk Analysis at the UW-Madison College of Engineering and a professor of industrial and systems engineering. She has worked on pandemic preparedness. She joined us today to talk about how policy experts and lawmakers can weigh public health concerns and guidelines amid the COVID-19 outbreak versus reopening the economy. Support conversations like this with your gift right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Time now for a look at some pets in the news. With people working from home and often having video meetings at home, pets are making their presence known. Here on Central Time, we've had cameo appearances from multiple cats at our remote morning meetings, which is actually kind of a nice touch. We should try to make that a regular thing, even when things get back to normalish. In the UK, a weather presenter doing a live broadcast from his home in front of a portable green screen was interrupted by his cat, Betty, who really needed some attention right away. The broadcaster picked up Betty and did the rest of his forecast with a very squirmy cat in his arms. Meanwhile, a lot of people are taking the opportunity to share various pet videos online, including one I saw of cows licking a cat. Nothing newsworthy there. I was just really cute. And at Madison.com, reporters went through city documents to find the most popular dog breeds in town. This is just Madison now, but I think there will be a number of common favorites just about anywhere you go. Number one, Labrador Retriever. Number two, Golden Retriever. Number three, German Shepherd. Number four, Australian Shepherd. And number five, it's the Beagle. See the full list over at Madison.com. It's pet news you can use. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.